On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Brian Curtis and I go round and round about different topics in tech, including Google's grip on the web, the FCC blocking some fees and taxes on tech, and more. It might be the end of the year, but we wanted to go out with a bang. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 321, recorded December 21st, 2018. TWiT Soapbox. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes today. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days. Why a shop? It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm Louis Moreski, your host, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you through this final live episode of 2018 alone. I need some help from some of my favorite people and, coincidentally, some of the smartest people in the enterprise tech, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, you are entering the holiday season with a bang, I think, with some amazing races I see.
Yeah, we've got the glasses today, not just because I wanted to look more scholarly, but had a little eye infection going. But I can still see the TWiT Riot clearly, and looking forward to a great final live broadcast of 2018.
Well, we can't enter the holiday season without the geek in paradise, the gadget man himself, Mr. Brian Chi, Director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, what are you cooking up for this holiday season?
I am actually cooking, discovering new recipes with the Instant Pot and things like that for the holidays. But I do want to tell everybody, please be careful. There seems to be some really nasty germies going around. In fact, I'm going to steal some of Lou's thunder and say, real bummer to our scheduled guest. He apparently caught something really nasty and lost his voice. And so we're going to have to just kind of talk about current events and so forth. So one of the things we'd kind of like to do is we're going to do roundtables and so forth, kind of talk about different things. But we definitely want to hear from the folks in the chat room so we can have more of an interactive show. So it ought to be fun.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, we have not one, but two, but maybe even four discussions today. It's the year end, but we want to make sure we get all of our opinions out there before we get to the holiday table, whether it's in-laws table or distant relatives. We need to get off our soapboxes right after this episode, so we need to get right into it. But, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about Google's grip on the web and the tech surrounding it, plus the FCC stepping in to stop some taxes and some interesting fees and a lot more. But before we do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, have you ever heard of filtering bubbles? Well, most tech companies are using your data to ensure they can personalize your experience, give you the advertisements that are interested to you, and as well as provide solutions close to your location. What they don't realize is that they're causing another issue, a filter bubble. Now, the person using a search engine might be missing out on more important data because their results are scoped to their location or area of interest. Now, this is exactly what CEO of DuckDuckGo says about Google in a study they recently provided. Now, if you remember, DuckDuckGo is a privacy-focused search engine company that competes with Google Search. Now, what the study reveals is that unintended consequences of auto-personalized filtering is that it causes unconscious and sometimes political bias. Now, the study, among others, found that participants saw vast differences in search results when searching for the same keywords like gun control or immigration from different locations across the country. The study controlled for other potential factors of personalization by having its participants log out of their Google accounts and search from an incognito state. Now, your results may seem more appealing when they're filtered because they are personalized to you, but the implications of not seeing the content that contradicts one's beliefs can sometimes have major consequences. Now, Google returned with a response to the study saying that the conclusions were flawed, but Google had no data to back up the rebuttal. What was the purpose of the study, you may ask? Well, it was focused on the hope that academics and corporations alike would spend more time on this unintended consequence and try to find a solution. It might be that time of the holiday season that you start searching for searching with a VPN and incognito mode after the new year.
Well, the U.S. is getting real about naming names in the hacker wars. In an indictment unsealed yesterday in Manhattan federal court, the Justice Department described Zhu Hua and Zhang Shilong as members of APT-10, a cyber espionage group working for the Chinese Ministry of State Security's Tianjin State Security Bureau. Through their involvement with APT-10, Zhu and Zhang are alleged to have broken into computers and networks belonging to numerous MSPs around the world in order to then gain access to systems belonging to the MSP's clients. Over the course of the MSP theft campaign, which began in 2014, Zhu and Zhang allegedly gained access to and stole data from computers belonging to organizations in various sectors, including banking, finance, manufacturing, consumer electronics, medical equipment, biotech, and automotive. The remarkable thing about this announcement is the very blunt language U.S. officials used in pinning the blame on the Chinese government. The fact that numerous other governments supported the announcement is also noteworthy. Indictments like these highlight the challenge the private industry faces in defending against well-funded, state-sponsored actors with little concern about reprisals, and the absolute need for those companies to be much more vigilant in protecting their intellectual property.
Here's a story from our friends across the pond. The National Health Services, aka the UK health system, is desperately in need of InfoSec professionals. The UK's national health system is desperately short of information security professionals, saying the research from InfoSec consultancy RedScan. The firm found that the NHS trusts typically have just one member of staff with cybersecurity credentials per 2,628 employees. A quarter of all trusts surveyed, which includes some of the largest trusts employing as many as 16,000 people, had no InfoSec professionals on their payroll whatsoever. The firm also looked at spending on cybersecurity training during the last 12 calendar months between trusts and found the expenditure varied wildly from as little as £238 to as much as £78,000. In several cases, RedScan found examples of trusts that spent nothing on specialist InfoSec or GDPR training. RedScan obtained the data by sending Freedom of Information requests to the UK's 159 trusts. Responses were received between August 20th and November 27, 2018. So while these numbers are for the UK, it doesn't take a huge stretch of the imagination to wonder if the US is in better shape or not. I would hope so. With the GDPR forcing compliance, I for one wonder if the weaker US privacy laws are crippling the US health industry. Could this lack of cybersecurity professionals be leading to the increased number of cryptojacking U.S. healthcare networks? Who knows?
Now, do you remember the battle here about the battle between Apple and Qualcomm? Well, it looks to have taken a turn for the, well, unfortunate. Now, the battle between the two companies has involved regulatory bodies and courts around the world, but essentially boils down to the licensing rates Qualcomm and other wireless intellectual property holders charge smartphone OEMs for use of their standard essential patents. Now, the dispute has resulted in legal battles over Apple's use of Qualcomm's non-essential patents. Now, the Fuzhou Intermediate People's Court in China ruled in favor of Qualcomm in two patent infringement lawsuits and granted an injunction on the importation and sale of any iPhone 6S through iPhone X in China. Now, in September, a U.S. ITC administrative judge preliminary ruled that Apple had infringed on Qualcomm's patents but recommended against granting import ban in some iPhones in the U.S. Because of this potential financial impact on Apple, the decision is likely to force both companies back to discussions where Apple's negotiating leverage is greatly reduced. Now, this may, or however, also force Apple into moving to Intel or TI modems in the future, which could have an effect on Qualcomm in the long term. If nothing else, the battle is far from over. So let's see what the new year brings.
Well, a new report says that cyber criminals are continuing to change their behavior across their landscape. For cyber criminals, the Internet of Things is becoming a bigger draw. Ransomware is still a profitable tool, and there are ways around even major legal actions. Those are just some of the conclusions in the McAfee Labs Threats Report for December 2018, which was released this week. In a continuing response to the legal takedown of major dark web markets like Hansa and Alphabay and the disappearance of Olympus Market, some criminals have started creating their own dark commerce sites where they do business with their customers. These smaller sites make it much more difficult for law enforcement to gain access and conduct surveillance on the criminal activity. And if that's not enough, another trend that makes life more challenging is a growing tendency for some criminals to forego the dark web-based market altogether and use communications networks like Telegram to conduct their business. The continuing growth of criminal affiliate networks is seen in the evolution and increase of these affiliate-architected malware, like the GandCrab ransomware package, and in the operation of RDP shops that sell remote desktop access to compromised servers so that criminals can install and run their illicit software from the comfort and convenience of their own dark basements. Now, according to researchers, quote, RDP continues to be an Achilles heel for many organizations, judging by the amount of targeted ransomware attacks, such as SamSam, BitPamer, and GandCrab, that leverage RDP as an entry method.
Well, our friends at the FBI have opened a criminal investigation into net neutrality comment fraud. The Federal Bureau of Investigation is investigating the use of stolen identities in public comments on the government's repeal of net neutrality rules, according to BuzzFeed this last Saturday. The investigation focuses on whether crimes were committed when potentially millions of people's identities were posted to the FCC's website without their permission, falsely attributing to them opinions about net neutrality rules, according to this report. Two organizations told BuzzFeed News, each on condition that they were not named, that the FBI delivered subpoenas to them related to the comments. The FBI subpoenas came a few days after similar subpoenas sent by the New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood in mid-October. Underwood subpoenaed more than a dozen telecommunications trade groups, lobbying contractors, and Washington advocacy organizations, according to a New York Times report in October. The New York Attorney General's office estimates up to 9.5 million comments on the FCC Commission's net neutrality repeal were submitted using stolen identities. But the New York Attorney General's office said in November 2017 that FCC Chairman Ajit Pai's office had refused to provide information needed for the investigation. So these kinds of numbers kind of make it look like maybe the FCC's support for revoking the Obama administration's net neutrality laws are being mislaid by millions of comments.
Well, folks, it's the holiday season and hackers are on the prowl for sparsely funded IT organizations and new poorly secured consumer devices. Well, this latest attack is no surprise for this time of year. A massive swarm of email bomb threats is prompting closures at hospitals, schools, public transit agencies, and businesses across the U.S. and Canada. Now, the emails warn that explosives have been planted in the recipient's premises and that they will detonate by the end of the day unless the target pays $20,000 in Bitcoin. Now, disruptions to the San Francisco Municipal railways, bus lines, and evacuations of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, San Francisco Fire Credit Union headquarters, and according to many chronicles over there, multiple hospital and business closures in Chicago, as reported by the city's ABC7, building closures and school lockdowns in Tampa, Florida, just to name a few. Fortunately, to date, there have been no physical explosives found in any of the reported cases. What's the end goal of such emails? Well, it isn't to make money. It's essentially to disrupt. It's a disruption technique or a honeypot for other means of attacks. Do your organization a favor and this holiday season, and don't let your guard down and let those evil elves in. Well, folks, That does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites, and we have that great roundtable we're going to do with the co-host. But first, we have to thank a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Now, you all know Red Hat as that open source company that's been bringing open source technologies to the enterprise for over 25 years. But Command Line Heroes layers on top of that with an original podcast that brings a set of developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels together in one show. Now, hosted by Saran Yabarak, she is the developer who co-founded Code Newbie and lives and breathes open source software. Command Line Heroes takes you through that journey and living in the command line and tracking the changes that shape the world of open source development. Now, from programming languages to learning more about supercomputers, hybrid clouds, and more, there are tons of fun topics, and they truly keep you up to date on the open source landscape and ecosystem. The season two finale brings everything together by seeing how open source powers some of the grandest projects, and what better way to see what we're capable of accomplishing with open source than with people responsible for taking the work out of this world. Now, Tom Satterstrom, Chief Technology Innovation Officer for IT at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, shares how innovation flourishes with open source, from projects we can all contribute to, like building our own rover, to more specialized needs like solar flare predicting. I want to build my own rover. So cool now. And we have Hila Lifshitz-Esaf, professor at Stern School of Business, confirms that more minds simply make for better work with her research on the agency's true embrace of open source. Now, if you haven't checked out Command Line Heroes yet, get out right now and visit redhat.com/heroes to check it out today. Subscribe to the Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. Visit redhat.com/heroes for extras and to learn more. That's redhat.com/heroes. And we thank Red Hat and Command Line Heroes for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we have a really promising and great episode today about some multiple discussions. We're going to do a roundtable between all the co-hosts. And we have this bite starting with Google. Now, over the past years, Google has been attempting to position itself as the center of gravity for the internet traffic and web-based technology. Now, not only have they become their own domain registrar, but they've also released proprietary tech that could benefit their sites and services. Now, how can they do this, you ask? Well, let's take a quick look at an inventory of some of the information. With Google Chrome, they have 65% of the browser market. Now, if you remember, just recently, Microsoft announced that the Edge browser name would actually live on, but they will bring the browser downstream in the market by making the core of its browser Chromium and the JavaScript engine V8, which comes from Google. Now, also, this percentage of browser share also includes 53% of the mobile market as well. With this, Google also exercises a considerable amount of influence over the direction of the web's development. Now, if you remember back in 2009, Google introduced the Speedy protocol, which is a proprietary replacement of HTTP, which addressed what Google saw as a certain performance issues with HTTP 1.1. Almost all browsers have adopted this variant. We also talked about in previous episodes about that new protocol called QUIC, Q-U-I-C, which is based on Speedy, which will almost definitely be branded as HTTP3. Google's websites being majority of today's internet traffic from Google Search, YouTube, and Gmail, Google has some push and pull to move the web in the direction they want it to go. Now, Google controls a large fraction of the web's streaming video, and the company has, on a number of occasions, made changes to YouTube that made it worse for other browsers. All right, guys, I want to bring it to you first. Let's start with Cheebert. Now, from a networking perspective, Google's soon to own numerous layers in the stack, including, you know, server-side like Node.js and with V8 driving that. What does this mean for the industry, what do you think?
It's basically Google flexing their muscles. There's an awful lot going on in the IETF and IEEE with how things are working on the internet. Now, on one hand, you know, I'm gonna go down the middle on this one. It's great that we're getting more efficient protocols. You know, love that. Especially as more and more people are using the web further and further away from the servers. You know, especially as you start getting more and more third world countries hopping onto the web. However, the IETF meetings, if you've ever been to one, is a lot of arguing. You know, there's no way of saying it. It's arguing. And you have different camps within the working groups trying to push their agenda. So obviously the big boys, the working group for browsers is a massive working group. And Google seems to kind of dominate that to the point where some of their protocols that they're proposing have become de facto standards rather than ratified standards. So I'm beginning to wonder how good that's going to be, because when you start having a giant like that pushing their agenda and only their agenda and managing to coerce the other people in the working group to ratify their view of the world as a standard, you start wondering what's happening to smaller guys. So like, for instance, the folks at Mozilla are crying foul with a really big voice. They're saying, well, now you're going to create a two browser market, and testing, you know, it sounds counterintuitive, but having only two browsers means you're going to start losing compatibility with some of the specialized things, you know, specialized browsers and so forth. I kind of wonder whether it's going to force the little guys out of the market. And that I don't think is good. I like having variety. I like the fact that there are some specialized browsers for things like there's actually a specialized browser for teeny tiny little LCD screens when you start working on Internet of Things. And I'm wondering if those are going to go away. You know, what do you think, Lou? You're involved with the development. Do you like having multiple choices, or from a development standpoint, is it just that much easier just to do two and you kind of ignore the small guys?
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, there's a whole concept of standards. And I think standards really help organizations build their software in a way where they can guarantee that it will live a long time. Because they know it'll work on multiple different browsers, it'll work in different environments, like you were saying, even in IoT and so on. And so if they follow these standards and these kind of, you know, ways of doing things, they can guarantee that it kind of will be the same, and they'll have to pay for less development costs along the wire. So I think it definitely helps. Now, with Google owning more market share here, we've seen them already kind of push the web standards in a particular direction. Now, have we seen this in the past? Yeah, we've seen this in the past. I mean, Microsoft has had its own kind of push by using IE's power of 80% of the browser market share years ago to kind of push some of the standards forward as well, and, you know, maybe in the direction they wanted to go as well. So I'm just hoping that this doesn't necessarily hurt by having less competition. We'll have to see. I mean, again, because there's no foundation that belongs to browser rendering engines and JavaScript engines, then there really does no kind of force to that direction. Now, there are web foundations, like Mozilla has Foundation and so on, that kind of pushes forward some of the standards. But that doesn't mean that the browsers have to adopt them. So I think that it's going to be tough. As you reduce down to less competition, you'll have kind of potentially a negative effect, but hopefully it'll be more positive on that side of things. I want to throw it over to Curtis too, because I want to see, you know, from an enterprise perspective, you know, a lot of organizations spend a lot of money on focusing on particular things. Like Chibert was saying, hey, like some of them used to build specifically for IE because they had a COM integration, or they used to have COM add-ins or something that would do something special. And now they had to move off of that as they move to things like Edge and other browsers. Is this going to hurt them even more now they have less competition?
Well, it could. And, you know, I certainly remember the days when there would be enterprise applications that were optimized not just for Internet Explorer, but for a particular version of Internet Explorer. And that's something that right. many organizations wrestled with for years afterward. And in many cases, they created huge security issues, because even though there had been vulnerabilities found in a particular build of Internet Explorer, the company couldn't switch off of it because they had optimized their application for particular features. You were correct, Lou, in pointing out that this is not new. Microsoft is far from the only company to do this. Novell did it. IBM did it. Cisco did it. And in many cases, they continue to do so because companies both have some pride, hubris, you might say, in what they do, and because they want a competitive advantage. The thing that I give Google some credit for is going ahead and calling this a new protocol, rather than saying that, well, we're still doing HTTP2. We're just doing our little addition to it. They're going ahead and saying, no, this is something different. So that's positive. I applaud that transparency. What I think I would love to see, though, is more companies coming out with this kind of advancement that they offer up. You know, if there could be more points of argument in those IETF meetings. This is frankly one of the side effects of so many different companies chopping their R&D funds to the core to try and boost quarterly profits. Universities don't have the incentive to come out with the new high-performance protocols. And there just aren't that many companies that are willing to invest the money to do so. I mean, Amazon could, but the odds are good that anything they did would be aimed at commerce rather than raw performance. So I am concerned by this, watching it. But I've seen this too many times to go around saying that this is somehow an instance of the sky falling. All it will take, frankly, is one slip up by Google to have some other company ready to leap in. And we'll be talking about a reshuffling of the browser wars and on a future show.
You know, there's kind of an interesting effect. I'm going to go and put on my botanist hat here. When you have a forest that has just one species of tree, if a disease hits that forest, you lose the entire forest. But when you have biological diversification, it makes for a healthier forest altogether. I think I'm going to use that as an analogy for the browser world. If there's going to be one dominant browser and there's a vulnerability that is going might creep in, probably going to creep in, that means the attack surface is dramatically increased. Now, I will say one thing. While I use Chrome as my primary browser, it is a CPU hog. When I do a top on my Mac, Chrome is almost always the number one user of CPU. And it's actually not just a straight line. It's actually an exponential curve. As you open more and more tabs, Chrome uses an exponential amount of resources to the point where, you know, I must reboot once in a while. So on one hand, I don't like a single entity, you know, like a single species forest in my analogy. I would like to have more choices. But I do hope that with Microsoft and Chrome and so forth kind of sharing resources, hopefully sharing some development, some of the efficiencies that I used to see in Edge will start creeping into Chrome, because Chrome needs to learn how to be more efficient. Their programmers or someone somewhere along the line is using resources like you have unlimited resources and you don't, especially as we start going into these really small mobile devices that are always on. We can't afford to have those small mobile devices with gobs and gobs and gobs of RAM, because RAM takes power. I'd love to see Chrome become just as efficient as Edge. I actually kind of like Edge, even though I'm on a Mac. I'll use Edge as my primary when I use my Surface Go. Mm-hmm. But I think we need some cross-pollination on efficiencies here.
Right. I mean, we've actually heard even from, I think it was Mozilla's CEO, Chris Beard. He says that fears that this consolidation could make things harder for Mozilla, an organization that exists to ensure that web remains a competitive landscape that offers meaningful options and isn't subject to any one company's control. So it goes back to what you guys were already saying, is that, you know, this can kind of veer the way that the web's going and technology is going, especially like you were saying, performance. I mean, a lot of these browsers, especially Edge and others, are focused on, you know, potential mobile devices like tablets that require to be on battery for a long time, that require to be on LTE modem. And so these types of things need to be optimized to handle it. Now, Now, obviously, the Chrome version for Android has done a pretty good job. But again, some of these tablets and bigger browsers that are full-blown, Windows or Mac or so on, obviously Mac and iOS, they don't support Chrome today. But especially these Android devices have been able to handle it. What do you guys think? I want you maybe to throw it to both of you the prediction for 2019. Where do you think that Firefox and Mozilla will go from here?
I'm going to jump in. I think Mozilla is hopefully going to rise to the occasion and say, hey, we're a much better browser, quote unquote. And maybe, just maybe, some clever people will go and say, gee, we can make a much more efficient browser and so forth. But like some of the folks said in the chat room, gee, I'd use Firefox if it was more reliable. So, okay, well, maybe. I want to see some choices. So I hope Mozilla is going to step up to the plate and hit a home run.
Well, I'll come back and I'll agree that I would like to see there be more competition. And, let's remember that Firefox was a real strong competitor in this marketplace until it got the reputation for being unwieldy, being a resource hog, and being top heavy. I used it myself for years before, as Brian was talking about with Chrome, I would have to reboot multiple times a day just because it had become so resource heavy. Now, what we're seeing and where I think we could see a company really come in, Firefox is good here, is in browsers that become the heart of an ecosystem. We've already seen in many cases where for mobile apps, they are web fronted. HTML5 is doing what it's supposed to, allowing the browser to be the basic user interface for a lot of apps. So when a particular browser can be the reliable, stable core of an entire application ecosystem, then it's going to see wins. Google with Chrome has been that for a while, but it's become an awfully unwieldy system. And it will be interesting to see whether any of the other competitors, whether from Microsoft, Apple, or Mozilla, can come back and show the world that they are that reliable pillar that the app ecosystem needs.
Right. Well, folks, that does it for that bite. We do want to move on to the next bite. And I think, Curtis, you can take the helm here.
Well, that I will do, because it lets me talk about a couple of things that I really enjoy talking about, and that's taxation and government action. In this case, the legislators in California had come up with what they thought was a really clever plan to increase government revenue by taxing, or putting fees on, in their language, text messages. Well, that really great idea was chopped off at the knees this week when the FCC forced California to drop the plan. Now, California telecom regulators had come up with this idea, but the FCC last week voted to classify text messaging as an information service rather than a telecommunication service. Now, information service is the same classification the FCC gave to broadband when it repealed net neutrality rules and claimed that states aren't allowed to impose their own net neutrality laws. This is being litigated in court now. But in this case, California's utility regulator chose not to challenge the FCC on regulation of text messaging. The California Public Utilities Commission, CPUC, was scheduled to consider the text messaging fee proposal at a meeting next month, but has pulled the item off the agenda after the FCC action. They had said, under California law, telecommunications services are subject to the collection of surcharges to support a number of CPUC public programs that subsidize the cost of service for rural Californians and for low-income disadvantaged communities, and provide special services for the deaf, the hard of hearing, and the disabled. This FCC vote, though, limits state authority over text messaging. So, let's look at what this actually says and what it might not. The FCC has never decided, for example, whether voice over IP is an information service or a telecommunications service. Until last week, text messaging was similarly unclassified. Now, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai argues that federal law prevents states from regulating information services. But a number of state attorneys general who sued the FCC over its net neutrality decision argue that the FCC can't preempt states in cases where the FCC has given up its own authority. So this is beginning to feel a bit like a showdown between the FCC and states over who can't do something. In other words, does the absence of a regulation at the federal level prevent regulation at the state level? Now, Chebert, I know that this is one of those topics where you have, well, some strength of feeling about what the FCC has been doing. So what do you think about their classification of text messages as an information service?
I like that. Yeah, I'm actually going to agree with the FCC on this, because SMS is a fairly old technology. And while it might sound like it could be regulated, it's migrating. It's not going to stay SMS forever. The multimedia versions, I can't even remember the acronym. It started with an R. It's going to look more like a web internet session than a text message in the future. So is it telecommunications or is it an information service? Ew, boy, oh boy. I don't think it should be regulated. I think all the millennials listening or watching would probably agree with me. I actually live and die by SMS messages, because I can send a text message in really, really low bandwidth areas. Even during emergencies when the airwaves are clogged, an SMS takes so little bandwidth that I can actually get in it. Now, should in emergency or at any time, should we worry about, can I even afford this because there's an extra surcharge on it, I think is totally and completely wrong. So, Chumley, yeah, should the FTC step in too? I think that's going to be dependent upon whether or not the California Public Utilities Commission decides to kind of dig in their heels and try and fight this. I think the FTC might need to step in, but I think ball's in the California court.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing here is that you'll notice that, you know, they've chosen a service that has been widely adopted because of the fact that, you know, a lot of these organizations, these companies like, you know, Sprint and AT&T or so on, that of now offering these unlimited mechanisms. And so the way that they're kind of I've actually heard them talk about this is, hey, well, we have a big problem, especially from a safety perspective, because people will answer messages while they're driving, or they have kind of unintended consequences to being distracted when they're doing things. And so the way we'll fix this is we'll tax them for it. And so maybe it'll be a deterrent to stop doing it. The only problem here is, you know, just as Curtis pointed out, is it might be a slippery slope, because this means that if they are able to, let's say, not tax SMS or text messages, they might move on to the next thing. They might move on to, you know, hey, how many voicemails do you use, or how often are you on the web, that kind of thing. And so, you know, the FTC or even the FCC is going to have their work come out for them, because the states might just kind of keep them in court forever on a lot of these things. So I'm wondering if there needs to be some greater push to prevent this from happening in the future.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting, because there's a part of me that can see both sides. I mean, as a cell service, this began in the same way that cell voice calls began. This was just an ancillary service on the same network. The other hand, this has become its own communications medium, its own network, if you will. And we haven't seen it be defined really clearly. It's one of many cases where the technology ran far ahead of laws and regulations. And I think that, the slippery slope argument is a very good one, because I can imagine a scenario of fee where, you know, let's say they did it the same way that states have traditionally done fees on communications, where it's either a flat fee, let's call it, you know, 7 cents per line for the SMS fee, or a percentage of the total SMS bill, you know, a quarter of 1%, something like that. Well, that's unlikely to be bank breaking for anyone. But once the principle of doing that is established, then other states or even municipalities could come along and say, well, since we have the principle of entering fees, we'll do our own, where we will charge a dime per message or something patently ridiculous. That's the point at which we need to have regulated earlier, and we'll have lost the chance. So while I'm not sure that I agree with where the FCC came down, I will agree that the FCC needed to decide. And now we can have courts that can and almost certainly will decide whether the court's decision is the right one. Chiebert, I want to look to you, because, you know, you've reported on a lot of these court decisions around this kind of thing. What do you think the odds are that the courts will get it right when it comes to deciding what the FCC can and can't do?
It all depends on what kind of advice they get, whether they're going to listen to which lobby or expert. You know, I was on the group that helped break the intra-LATA telecommunications monopoly here in Hawaii about a year before the feds did it. It was actually good for the market. It's all about who you know provides the expertise, so to speak. My personal opinion about this whole thing is it's a dive for money. And we need to say no, our tax burden is actually really high. If you ever look at the itemized version of your telecommunications bill, there is an awful lot of fees and surcharges and taxes on there. A lot of people don't realize, you know, things like gasoline in Hawaii, over, I think, close to half the cost of the gasoline in Hawaii per gallon is taxes. I'm sorry, you know, we as Americans pay an awful lot of tax. I really and truly think we need to try and, you know, make things more efficient rather than, well, let's dig deeper in the consumers' pockets and pick their wallets. No, I think that's wrong. So I am really and truly hoping that the courts actually do the right thing.
Well, folks, we've gone through a couple bites here. We're definitely going to come back after the ad, and we'll talk a little bit more about 5G and some other things. But before we do have to thank a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, home buying is not easy. It's one of those stressful things and processes you normally don't want to have to go through, especially if you're refinancing your home. Now, I remember buying my last house. It wasn't fun. I had to deal with multiple banks and different bank reps. I had to search through my information through filing cabinets and so on. And I also had to worry about interest rate hikes, because, you know, as time goes on, those interest rates change. And plus, it took forever. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage noticed all the pitfalls in the process and are doing something about it. And they're calling it the power buying process. Now, here's how it works. Answer a few simple questions, and they'll check your credit for pre-qualified approval. In less than 24 hours, they'll give you a verified approval. Now, what is that? Well, that gives you the strength of a cash buyer. And now, in some markets, people are giving offers right at open houses, since it's a seller market. Now, having this in your hand is a golden ticket to getting that home you've been looking for a while. Now, once you're verified, you are qualified for their all-new exclusive rate shield approval. Now, first, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. Now, you're probably thinking, if the rate goes down, they're not going to tell me. That's not true. If the rate goes down, your rate also drops. Now, if you ask me, as a buyer, you seem to have the upper hand, because either way, you're winning. Now, this is just the kind of thing you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender, Rocket Mortgage. Now, you have an inkling or a possibility of buying a home soon, go out right now to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise, and in less than 10 minutes, your info could be entered, and you're on your way to home buying freedom. Now, get started. Go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Rate shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That is rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, back to the bites. We're going to jump over and hand it over to Cheeber to talk about 5G.
Hey, we're all waiting for 5G, and right now, there's no low-power chips. So what this story is talking about is AT&T is rolling out very, very limited 5G. Now, that particular hotspot is actually using a really, really hefty CPU. In fact, this is the Qualcomm Snapdragon 855 system on chip, which is mega overpowered for your typical hotspot, but it has 5G on it. So this ought to be really interesting. Truth be told, yeah, this is cool. It actually also works with LTE, so I actually bought one. It's $289 on Amazon. So anyway, it's called a Netgear Nighthawk 5G mobile hotspot. It's designed for a fixed. You know, this is not a phone. We aren't going to see phones for a while. We need to see the low-powered chips. But right now, Qualcomm and some of the other guys haven't released the low-power chips, so we're probably not going to see it until much later in 2019. Ought to be interesting. Anyway, so this is the first generation of the 5G hardware, so significantly bigger, uses more power, and is much more mature than the 4G hardware that Qualcomm has been refining for years. At this time, the article doesn't say what kind of sizes, and we don't have any really big specs, but the Netgear Nighthawk is about yay big. It's about the size of a small smoke detector. I've been playing with one that a friend has, and it is wicked fast, so it ought to be interesting. Wicked fast on 4G LTE. And I bought one in preparation for when 5G becomes available. Now, in Honolulu, we've been told that Verizon will be rolling out some 5G in limited areas. They actually went into cooperative partnership with Hawaiian Electric in hopes of being able to use some of the 5G and also 4G to bring data out of photovoltaic production systems on the households. So that's going to be really interesting. Basically, what this is doing is saying 5G is probably going to be fixed right at the very beginning. We're not going to see handsets too early. But what we are going to have with the fixed 5G wireless is real competition for the wired guys. The cable TV, you know, in Honolulu, it's Spectrum. Hawaiian Telephone does fiber to the home in some cases. But with 5G, we're talking about gig to the home on a wireless, and that's pretty cool. And in reality, Siklu Corporation just came out with and got their 5G certification. And I actually work for a wireless internet service provider, and we're using Siklu, and we can actually drop 10 gig wireless around town. So we have a wireless 10 gig backbone, and we're dropping wireless to apartment buildings in certain areas of Honolulu. So anyway, the cool thing about this is it's going to be a game changer for a lot of people. AT&T in their press release were saying it's going to be partially live only in a few cities, Atlanta, Charlotte, Dallas, Houston, Indianapolis, Jacksonville, Louisville, Oklahoma City, New Orleans, Raleigh, San Antonio, and Waco. And on a smaller part, it's going to be Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Nashville, Orlando, San Diego, San Francisco, and San Jose. Now, what I'd like to do is, you know, Kurt's Mr. Enterprise. What do you think, man? You think this is going to have a pretty big impact on small to medium-sized enterprises?
You know, I really think that it will, because one of the things that many of us take for granted is reliable broadband access. And even in metropolitan areas, we find that the coverage, both from a wireless and a cable size, is spottier than we really imagine. So I think there are a lot of smaller companies doing everything from warehousing and delivery to service to retail that will use this to improve their service to their customers. You know, just think of all of the times when you have been at a small retail establishment, whether it's hospitality or buying some product, where they're having trouble with the credit card machine, with the connectivity. They have trouble getting the sales complete because of a slow connection. Something as simple as that can be addressed with reliable 5G connections, speeding up the process of sales, therefore allowing more sales to take place, lowering the friction for customers, therefore making those customers happier, and ultimately reducing customer churn for the business and improving the bottom line. So I think that we're going to see a lot of small to mid-sized businesses looking for ways to take advantage of 5G once it's actually there and priced for the small to mid-sized enterprise.
The interesting thing here is I'm seeing an interesting problem that the industry is having with, especially with 5G, is that a lot of companies, like for instance, OnePlus is put out their 6T device, their OnePlus 6T device, and it's supposed to be 5G compatible. Now, the interesting thing here is the way they decided is they included a sub 6 gigahertz radio antenna, but unfortunately, it's actually not compatible with Verizon or AT&T's millimeter wave based 5G. Now the interesting thing here is I thought that this was supposed to be a standard where they said, hey, this is the frequency that they're going to work in, this is the band, this is how the kind of the technology is supposed to work. And so when devices actually put out a 5G compatible device, that it would actually work on these networks, right? I think the interesting thing is the 6T is one of the less expensive devices. It is their flagship device from OnePlus. I've been using it for a while. It's actually a pretty exceptional device. And I'll tell you one thing. I was hoping that it would be compatible. So especially if the network was to come to the Pacific Northwest, whether it's Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile, any of these, it would be compatible. I actually get to use it. But now I'm worried. Now I'm worried that it's not going to work. Because of the fact, so they're advertising 5G is kind of in quotes compatibility. I want to throw it to you guys. What does that even mean, like 5G compatibility? Isn't it supposed to be standardized?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk. So when I had the press, you know, the big presentation by Sequel, it says, yes, we're truly 5G, and because they're talking about millimeter wave, and they're using, quote, the same definition as Verizon and AT&T. Basically, a lot of people are saying 5G is based on speed capability. In theory, these guys are saying upwards of 20 gig per second, which would be pretty cool. Obviously, it's going to be bridges and backbones. So are we going to see – I'm feeling like it's going to be the early days of mobile telephones where there was CDMA, there is GSM, and so forth. There's going to be some competing standards in the 5G arena because there's so much potential money involved. You know, when we start talking about follow the money, that's going to be one of the big things. And for the first time, really and truly, traditional mobile vendors like Verizon and Sprint and so forth and T-Mobile are actually going to be able to compete directly with the wired vendors. You know, we all kind of remember that old fixed wireless system, and now I can't remember the name, anyway, they had to give up their spectrum, and that spectrum became part of the LTE band. Cradle point. Anyway, there has been, and it was actually pretty popular back in the day, even though I can't remember the name, but fixed point wireless has an amazing amount of potential. And I got to imagine one thing that's going to be really, really cool is going to be for the people with RVs, because with that kind of bandwidth capability, and, you know, you just can't be moving, so there's no roaming at the beginning. We're going to be able to watch our, you know, YouTube and our different video from an RV, even if we might be just in a national park someday. Ought to be interesting.
So this actually makes it difficult for hardware vendors too, because you get, now that you've done it standardized, it's not saying, hey, this is the technology of the band that you're going to be using. The potential is the silicone in the devices have to potentially change depending on what network they work on. Now, we saw the consolidation of this technology recently, where they have these radios now, that these chips that can support both the GSM based technology, CDMA technology, and different bands on there. Now they're going to have one that's going to support 5G in different bands at different frequencies, and they're going to have to kind of future-proof these things going forward. So I think it almost be more expensive for companies to adopt 5G, and almost I would say almost killing the standard as we move forward, unless they find a way to standardize and make it easier. So companies like Qualcomm and Intel are going to need to find ways to standardize this, or if not, make it easier for single things, bands to be on the same device, on the same silicone. I know. I mean, from an enterprise perspective, what do you think, Kurt? Is this going to help or hurt the market?
Well, I think it's going to be one of these cases where very early on, the enterprises that are early adopters will just accept vendor lock-in. I'm reminded of the early days of the iPad, when if you went to a vendor to buy an iPad and you wanted cellular capability, you had to choose which of the wireless vendors you wanted to use for your network, because they were different radios and you had to have different models of the iPad. We got past that. And, coming up on a decade on, I think that a lot of people have forgotten those bad old days. The same sort of thing is going to happen with the enterprises, which means, among other things, that early days will see us on enterprise contracts rather than so much BYOD for this. The company will have a contract that they negotiate with a carrier. They'll get the carrier's equipment. It'll be a nice big lock-in for the term of the contract, 2 years probably. And after that, with any luck at all, things will get more competitive. This is one of those cases where I think if I were recommending to a company, I would say let people with a true critical need be the early adopters. Wait for things to settle out just a little bit and wait for that inevitable standardization to happen. We're going to see radios with multiple frequencies. We're going to see devices that will do multiple networks, just like we do on cell phones today. It might be worth waiting a year or two until we get there before you jump into the 5G market.
Well, I want to bring up a point. We actually talked about it in a previous show about 5G micro cells attaching to poles. Because of the frequency and wavelengths that they're talking about, we're not talking about huge, huge distances here. So we're going to have more of these micro cells slung all over the place. So that's going to be a really, really big issue also with 5G. And it's probably one of the reasons why the list of cities for AT&T was so small. And, when you start talking about, frequencies that high, we're also talking about not having a whole heck of a lot of penetration into buildings. So the 5G in the handheld and mobile is going to have to do a whole lot of bopping back and forth between 5G when you're outside to start with, and then dropping back to 4G inside a building. So it's going to be a really, really interesting coming year. as standard starts getting, you know, hammered out, and also as the handshaking as we pass off between 5G and 4G is going to be a really interesting conversation in the standards committees.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you have done it. Again, you sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 Elves on the Shelves. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host in crime, with whom I would not want to do this without them. I would not want to do the show. It's been a pleasure doing this show with you guys this year. Happy holidays to you both. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, Lou, it's a great pleasure being with you. The happiest holidays of holidays to you and yours. And as for my work, well, you can still find me at darkreading.com. Got a new piece up just this afternoon on business metrics that security pros really ought to know. I'll have more stuff coming up next week and in the coming year. So check me out there. If you want to find out when I'm doing new stuff, just follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA.
Thanks, Curtis. Of course, we have to thank our geek in paradise and our tireless producer, Mr. Brian T. Chiebert. Can tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work.
I am ADVNETLAB on Twitter. I'm also Chiebert at twit.tv. Or better yet, why don't you send that email with the show suggestions to Twyatt at twit.tv, and that way it hits all the hosts. We are working as hard as we can to try and get show topics you folks have been requesting. Right now it's a little hard because it's the holidays, and I'm actually shocked at how many companies are shutting down from this week through the new year. So I wish the university would, hint, hint, hint. But anyway, happy holidays to everybody. And in Hawaiian, that would be mele kalikimaka e ho'oli makahiki ho.
Happy holidays to you both. Happy New Year as well. Also, we want to thank you as well. You are the person that drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness, and we couldn't do the show without you. We want to make it easier for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. Go to the show page right now to twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes this whole year of great episodes that we've had, as well as all the show notes, co-host guest information, and the links to the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful download or subscribe links. Support the show by getting an audio version, video version, HD video version, and listen on any one of your devices. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise news. So go ahead and do that. After you subscribe, share the show with your friends and family and coworkers. You should make it a New Year's resolution to listen for more Twyatt. We love and do this show. We love doing this show. We can keep doing it if you support us. Now, after you subscribe, also remember, we do this show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, live.twit.tv. Come see how the pizza's made. And of course, if you're going to jump in and watch it live, go ahead and jump into the chat room live as well, irc.twit.tv. Now, we love the chat room. We've had a great discussion. We had some great questions from the chat room today, some great discussion points. We appreciate them being there and supporting us as well. Also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMalm. You'll get to see what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. Check out dev.office.com, where we post all of our latest and greatest ways to customize Office. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, everyone at Twit. There, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit, and also thank you to Brian Chi, who is our producer. He kind of keeps us on our toes and also makes sure that all the guests and everything is lined up and the show going smoothly. So thank you to Brian. Also, before we sign out, I also have to say thank you, happy holidays to our TD, Kevin, today. Kevin, you know, we didn't have a guest today, but what was the main theme of the show today?
Gingerbread and milk and presents.
Oh, so close. I think it's just don't trust the elves in the machine. But thank you so much for playing, and happy holidays to you and all of your coworkers there. Well, folks, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, and just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twyatt.